The headlines this hour: Muslims in Iran and other countries mark Tasua, the day before the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. At least three people are reportedly killed during a protest against the Taliban in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad. And Iran has set up temporary camps along its border with Afghanistan to host a steady influx of Afghan refugees. We'll have a report. Thanks for joining us. Muslims around the world are marking Tasua one day before the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Tasua is the ninth day of the month of Muharram in the Islamic calendar. The day precedes Ashura, when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in 680 AD. They were killed by the tyrant of their time, Yazid, during the Battle of Karbala. Tasua is devoted to Imam Hussein's half-brother, Abbas ibn Ali, who made proverbial sacrifices during the battle. The annual rituals attract millions of mourners in various countries. But this year, like the previous ones, many large gatherings have been canceled due to the pandemic. Iranians across the country have also commemorated Tasua by holding mourning ceremonies while observing health protocols.
منم برادر حسین که شاه عالمین است منم برادر حسین که شاه عالمین است
الله باب الهوائد حسین حسین جان
تو امید حرم فاطمیونی.
Political commentator Omar Nashabi explains how Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary acts as a reminder for Muslims of their duties today, including those towards the Palestinian people.
We should always maintain this central issue for all Muslims and all people who believe in justice around the world. The issue of Palestine comes back every time. And in every Ashura, we have to maintain that the people of Palestine are like Imam Hussein. They are not to be left alone. And all Muslims all around the world should stand in solidarity with the struggle of the Palestinian people. And this was the main instruction and guidance of Imam Khomeini.
Security forces in Indian-controlled Kashmir have attacked Shia Muslims, preventing them from holding a religious procession in the region's capital city. The event was meant to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Islam's Prophet Muhammad. Sayyid Ali Safi has more.
Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussein slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last 3 decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Sayyidri Safid, Indian-administered Kashmir.
At least three people are reportedly killed during a protest against the Taliban in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad. According to sources, over a dozen people were also injured after Taliban members opened fire at the protesters. The clashes erupted as people took to the streets after the Taliban raised their own flag by replacing Afghanistan's national flag in an important square. Video footage showed hundreds of Afghans also held and waved the national flag in the streets of Jalalabad. Kabul Airport continues to be the scene of chaos as Taliban militants fire shots into the air to disperse crowds desperate to flee Afghanistan. Taliban officials said that they do not intend to harm anyone. He blamed Western forces for their, quote, chaotic evacuation plan from Afghanistan for the disarray. The Pentagon said U.S. troops guarding the evacuation bid at the airport also fired shots overnight in crowd control efforts. A NATO security official said that 17 people were injured in a stampede at an airport gate. A Western official also said that about 5,000 people, including diplomats, foreign and Afghan nationals, have been evacuated from Kabul in the past 24 hours. A U.S. official said the number of American troops at Kabul's international airport reached about 4,500 and is expected to hit 6,000 in the coming days. Meanwhile, China has once again criticized Western nations for their military intervention in Afghanistan and leaving the country in chaos.
Facts have once again proved that some countries' military interventions against other sovereign states, conducted under the banner of the so-called democracy and human rights, have seriously undermined the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the affected countries, causing serious damage to their economic and social development.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson added that the West military intervention led to the killing and displacement of a large number of Afghans. Moscow has also made similar remarks, lashing out the U.S. and its allies for the current situation in Afghanistan. The Russian Foreign Ministry said the West has left a new humanitarian and political crisis for future generations in the Central Asian country. It said that the events that have unfolded there in recent days show the West's actual attitude toward human rights. U.S. allies are looking on with concern at the chaotic U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. In South Korea, the leader of the ruling Democratic Party has called for the acceleration of the takeover of wartime operational control of the country's forces from the U.S. In a Facebook post, Song Yong-gil said that Seoul needs swift OPCON transfer to further strengthen its will and capability of self-defense against the backdrop of the Afghanistan crisis. Song was responding to a, quote, slanderous Twitter message by a U.S. columnist comparing South Korea to Afghanistan. Mark Thiessen had said, without U.S. support, South Korea would collapse just as quickly as the Afghan government under sustained assault from the north. Over 28,000 American troops are stationed in South Korea. Since the Korean War 70 years ago, the U.S. has retained the authority to control South Korea and its own forces if another conflict breaks out. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the Taliban would be judged on their actions after the group sought to convince the world that they would not seek revenge after seizing Afghanistan.
We will judge this regime based on the choices it makes and by its actions rather than by its words. On on its attitude to terrorism, to crime and narcotics, as well as humanitarian access and the rights of girls to receive an education.
Johnson warned countries against prematurely or bilaterally recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate rulers of the country. The British premier also said that it was an illusion to believe any nation in the NATO alliance would restart military action. He said the appetite for continued military presence or for a military solution ended with the conclusion of NATO's combat mission in 2014. Johnson was addressing a parliamentary session on Afghanistan where he faced critical questions from lawmakers over the chaotic evacuation from Kabul and the unfolding situation in the country. In the meeting, Labour leader Keir Starmer censored Johnson for lack of preparation, saying that his judgment had been appalling.
On its attitude, it should concern us all that the Prime Minister's judgment on Afghanistan has been appalling. He was in a position to lead, but he didn't. Britain holds a seat at the United Nations Security Council. We're a key player within NATO. We're chair of the G7. Every one of these platforms could and should have been used to prepare for the withdrawal of forces, to rally international support behind a plan to stabilise Afghanistan through the process and keep us safe. I will give way in just a minute. But what did
The Labour leader also criticized Johnson for a major miscalculation with regard to Afghan forces and the Taliban. Separately, former Prime Minister Theresa May said the events had been shocking and represented a major setback to the British foreign policy. She accused Johnson of just following the U.S. and ignoring their own intelligence on Afghanistan. Taliban's quick takeover of Afghanistan has surprised the West, with many nations scrambling to get their diplomats and other staff out. The Taliban have said that they want peace and will not take revenge against old enemies. In the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan, Iran has seen a steady influx of Afghan refugees. Iran's border police have set up temporary camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to host the inbound refugees. Yusuf Jalali is there and has filed this report.
Aside from the tumultuous stories of Afghanistan, there's a story of a quest for peace, an epic trek that took this Afghan family 48 hours on foot to get to neighboring Iran. Like thousands of Afghans who sought asylum in Iran in the wake of the Taliban rule, Maryam, her husband, and their kids tried to cross into Iran. But the distraught family took the wrong path that led them to climb the border wall overnight, only for pregnant Maryam to lose her grip and fall on her stomach on the Iranian side of the border. First aiders stationed on the Iranian border say Maryam lost her baby. She was sent to the nearest hospital for abortion.
We have lost everything in our country. We are not sure what will happen to us and our kids and how the Taliban will govern Afghanistan. It takes months for things to get back to normal in our country, and this is why we decided to come to Iran.
Upon their arrival in Iran, the Afghan family were caught by Iran's border police, who then took them to this temporary camp filled with hundreds of Afghan asylum seekers who have led an uncertain future in their country, as their former president, Ashraf Ghani, fled Afghanistan and handed over power to the Taliban.
I don't care who takes power in Afghanistan. We need our country to be free and independent. We need peace after years of chaos inflicted on us by Americans and their allies.
I should thank the Iranian government for accommodating us in these camps. We urge the Iranian authorities to accept us as refugees and let us live here. We have nothing to lose in Afghanistan. We lost our businesses, and Iran is now our only hope.
Iran is home to some 800,000 registered Afghan refugees. Over 2 million more are undocumented. Iran's border police predict as long as the political landscape in Afghanistan is unclear, the flow of refugees will not subside.
Afghan refugees here say they have fled a future that's shrouded in uncertainty. They're now trying to seek a new life in a country that has already housed millions of Afghans over the past decades, something which shines a glimmer of hope that they could finally find peace after years of chaotic life back home. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian-Afghan border.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that his country is ready to cooperate with China and Russia to establish peace and security in Afghanistan. Raisi, in a phone call with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, condemned Washington for its interference in Beijing's internal affairs. The Iranian president also reiterated Tehran's support for the One China principle. Raisi further slammed the U.S. for its approach toward international treaties, saying that Washington must remove all anti-Iran sanctions. His comments were echoed by Xi, who said Washington's withdrawal was the reason why the 2015 nuclear deal is now in crisis. The Chinese president said he supports Iran's logical demands regarding the agreement. Raisi also discussed the nuclear agreement with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. They talked about the prospects of resuming the negotiations aimed at reviving the deal. Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. and its NATO allies have a clear obligation to compensate Afghanistan for the invasion and two decades of occupation there. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the remarks in reference to U.S. and NATO claims that they were battling terrorism or attempting to bring democracy to Afghanistan. Zarif refuted those claims, saying that their invasion and occupation was simply aimed at pursuing their own interests. He further added that the U.S. and its NATO allies, however, failed to achieve their goals despite two decades of presence in the war-torn nation. On Sunday, Zarif had also voiced his country's readiness to help establish peace and reconciliation in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Brazil has logged over 37,000 new daily COVID-19 infections and over 1,100 deaths. The figures put the South American country's total confirmed cases at over 20.4 million and its deaths at over 570,000. Brazil is the world's third worst nation in terms of coronavirus infections. It's also witnessed the world's second deadliest outbreak after the U.S. In Mexico, more than 14,000 people have been diagnosed with the disease in a 24-hour time period. Reported 877 new deaths. Mexican authorities say the actual figures are probably much higher than the official data. And that is World News. Bye-bye for now.
Today, 9th of Muharram, is the day of Tasua, the day before the heartrending tragedy of Karbala. We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of Tasua.
The limelight.
Recently, a group of child rights experts have strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding eight parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Alan Rock, who was Canada's ambassador to the UN from 2003 to 2006 and served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, titled, UN Should Stop Playing Politics with Children's Lives. The article was published by the Al Jazeera website. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. children around the world suffer the consequences of war. They're routinely killed, maimed, recruited to fight, and otherwise abused. In 2020, the United Nations reported more than 25,000 such grave violations in the previous year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has powerful tools at his disposal to pressure those responsible to end such abuses, but he is failing to use them, often placing politics above children's lives. Over the past 20 years, the UN Security Council has put in place a framework to protect children in conflict zones. It requires the Secretary General to report every year on grave violations against children, including killing and maiming, recruiting child soldiers, sexual violence, and bombing schools. The Secretary General is required to attach a list of those responsible to his report. The list of shame, as it is sometimes called, is the linchpin for holding parties accountable for grave violations. When used as intended, the list has been a remarkably effective tool. Governments and non-state armed actors alike dread the stigma of being listed and are motivated to engage with the UN on steps they can take to end their abuses and be removed from the list. Alan Rock wrote, "I have seen for myself the power of the list. In 2006, I served as a UN Special Advisor on Children and Armed Conflict in Sri Lanka, where I met with dozens of heartbroken families whose children had been abducted by the Tamil Tigers or the government-linked Tamil Makal Pukal, that is TMVP, and forced to fight in Sri Lanka's civil war. The TMVP was added to the list of shame in 2006. Following intensive dialogue with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, it signed and implemented an action plan to end the abductions, and it was removed from the list in 2011. Rock said, "At that time, there was a palpable sense of optimism among those of us working to protect children in armed conflicts. We saw the Secretary General's list as a strong instrument to root out practices like recruiting child soldiers. And for many years it was. In addition to the TMVP in Sri Lanka, the list shamed many others into changing their ways. Among them, the Maoists in Nepal, government forces in Chad, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. However, in recent years, decisions about listing have become increasingly politicized, undermining the list's potential to protect children. For example, in 2016, the UN's then Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, removed the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from his list. Even though coalition airstrikes massacred more than 450 children and injured hundreds the previous year. The reason? Saudi threats to withdraw UN funding. Although Secretary General Guterres returned the Saudi coalition to his list in 2017, he removed it again in 2020, despite the UN's own findings that the coalition was responsible for at least 222 child casualties the previous year. Guterres has also removed the Myanmar Armed Forces, the Tatmadaw, from the list for recruiting and using children, despite hundreds of documented violations in 2019 and 2020. Rock noted, "These betrayals prompted me to join a group of international children's rights experts to conduct a systematic review of the Secretary General's listing and delisting decisions over the past decade and to make recommendations to end the politicization of this process." The author of this article said, "The extent of the discrepancies we found was shocking. There is a clear mismatch between information about violations documented by the UN itself and the groups and government forces on the list. Our review identified dozens of cases in which multiple violations did not lead to listing or in which listing decisions reflected unexplained inconsistencies." Rock continued, Our analysis also found that government forces have often had a free pass for committing violations. Of 8 parties responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children in a one-year period that were not listed, 6 were governments, including state armed forces or occupation forces in Afghanistan, the DRC, the Israeli regime, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia. Israeli troops, terrorists, and occupation forces in Afghanistan have each been responsible for thousands of child injuries and deaths since 2014, but have never been listed. Alan Ra concluded, protecting children among the most vulnerable in war should be a politics-free zone. Their interests should be paramount when calling out abuses. Secretary General Guterres needs to address the issues we have identified and produce a credible, accurate, and evidence-based list in his upcoming annual report. Treating parties to conflict based on their conduct, not their political influence, is the only way to restore the list as a powerful tool in responding to grave violations against children in war. Recently, a group of child rights experts has strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding 8 parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. In a report, experts from Watch List on Children, an international child rights group, said at least 8 parties to conflicts were found responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children in a single year, but were excluded from the blacklist. The report said there were numerous discrepancies and omissions in listing decisions, as well as unwarranted delisting decisions, noting that the UN Security Council's 2001 resolution establishing the list to protect children from the horrors of war is being seriously undermined and could result in putting children at even greater risk. The report said the Secretary General's 2015 annual report acknowledges that the number of children killed by the Israeli regime in 2014 was the 3rd highest in the world, and the number of schools damaged or destroyed was the highest anywhere in the world that year. And yet, the Israeli regime has not been listed in the report's annexes. It added that at the time, the news media reported that the Zionist regime and the United States conducted intense lobbying to prevent the regime's blacklisting. The child rights experts also cited annual reports that have repeatedly found the Israeli regime forces responsible for high levels of Palestinian child casualties, including over 1,525 killed and maimed in 2020 alone. They added, yet, Israeli regime forces have yet to be included in the annexed list of violations. According to the AP, co-author Yangi Li, former chair of the committee that monitors implementation of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, said, "We are calling on the Secretary General to urgently address these problems and commit to hold all countries and groups responsible for violations against children accountable without fear or favor." In response to the report, UN spokesman Stephanie Dujarric said Secretary General Antonio Guterres stands by the report's conclusions, expressing willingness to engage with relevant partners in how to improve the system. Benyam Dwight Mizmor, another co-author of the report, urged the UN to ensure that the list of perpetrators it issues is more credible, accurate, complete, an evidence-based, or risk pulling apart this unique tool for the protection of children caught in war. The report also said the Saudi-led war coalition against Yemen was delisted in 2020 for killing and maiming children in the Arab country, despite being responsible for a documented 222 child casualties during the reporting period. It noted, with this delisting, the Saudi-led coalition has been removed from the Secretary General's list altogether. citing the Secretary General's reports that said the Saudi-led coalition was delisted due to a sustained significant decrease in the number of violations they committed. The rights experts said such argument runs counter to the established delisting criteria. They maintained this runs counter to the delisting criteria established in 2010 and the Security Council's stated expectations that listing is based on whether or not grave violations against children took place in violation of international obligations. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, the Saudi war on Yemen has killed 250,000 people, including women and children, since it was launched in March 2015 with the aim of restoring the Riyadh-friendly government of former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Ya Abu Abdullah. Ya Mawla. What happened in Karbala what had you done to deserve this treatment ya Mawla Ya Aba Abdullah What had you done that they were so adamant not only to not allow you to have any water They didn't allow the young children to have any water. They didn't allow your flag bearer to deliver just a bit of water. Ya Hussein. يا فاطمة الزهراء I'm sure you were in Karbala How did you watch Hussein hold Ali al-Asghar above his head asking for water and getting an arrow as a response. Ya Zahra, how did you watch Zainab come out on Tal al-Zainabiyyah? And see الشمر جالس على صدري I'm sure you were in Karbala Some have said After Abbas went to the Sharia When he was trying to get water for the children When he entered the Sharia Imagine Abbas Having been fighting for an entire day without water in the heat of Karbala. I don't know if you've experienced extreme thirst or not. Once you feel the coolness of water, your urge to have water is more. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas entered the Sharia. His feet probably touch the water. He feels the coolness of the water. He grabs some in his hands. He raises it. His hands feel the cool as well. فذكر عطش الحسين. He remembers the thirst of Imam al-Husayn. He pours it back. Moves towards the tents of Imam al-Husayn. The lady Fatima al-Zahra was in Karbala. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas moves towards the tents. They ambush him. The lady Fatima al-Zahra is watching Bunayya. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas begins to fight, hoping to get the water to the tents for the children. A mal'oon strikes his right arm from the back. Wallahi in qata'atumu yamini inni uhami abadan an dini. Imagine Abbas holding the water skin with his teeth, fighting with his left arm. Another mal'oon from the rear. Fatima is watching. His arm is severed. Trying to get the horse to go faster towards the tents. But in Mal'oon, they start shooting arrows. One of the arrows pierces through the water skin. Abbas sees the water. It's spilling. There's no more hope for the water to reach the tents. He changes direction, they say. I don't want to move towards the tents anymore. I promised the children water. But he continues to go. Another mal'oon takes an iron rod. Again from the rear on the head of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is to fall. When you want to fall from an elevation, if you are to fall from any elevation, even when you're standing, you use your arms to break your fall. But Abbas has no arms. Fatima al-Zahra is there, they sing. She broke his fall. Perhaps for this reason he calls, Ya Akha, Adrik Akha. Ya Hussein, Ruhi Fadak. Arriving on the armless body of Abbas. How can I help? when you remove some of that blood in my eye. I want to see you one last time. Ruhi fidaka ya Mawla. Has been recorded to have said, "Al-an inkasara dhahri." At this point, my back was broken. Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimin. Wa sayalamu al-nazina zalamu ayyamun qalabin yanqalibun.
How can I forget the burning of tents? Cries that will rock my heart, leaving my soul torn apart. Can Hussein be left alone? Can Hussein be left all alone in this battlefield? Can Hussein be left all alone in this battlefield?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Recent papers produced by the UK government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE, have suggested that the arrival of a coronavirus variant that evades vaccines is a realistic possibility. We've prepared for you an article written by Michael Savage. The piece has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. It's titled, "Experts warn UK government new COVID variants would set us back a year." Ministers are being pressed to reveal what contingency plans are in place to deal with a future COVID variant that evades current vaccines, amid warnings from scientific advisers that such an outcome could set the battle against the pandemic back a year or even more. Recent papers produced by the UK government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, have suggested that the arrival of a variant that evades vaccines is a realistic possibility. SAGE-backed continued work on new vaccines that reduce infection and transmission more than current jabs, the creation of more vaccine production facilities in the United Kingdom, and laboratory-based studies to predict evolution of variants. With the arrival of a new variant seen as one of the main dangers that could intensify the crisis once again, prominent scientific figures stressed the risk. Professor Graham Medley, a member of SAGE and a leader of the government's COVID modelling group, said it was clearly something that the planners and scientists should take very seriously, as it would put us back a long way. He said, "It is not that different to the planning that needs to be done between pandemics. A new variant that was able to overcome immunity significantly would be essentially a new virus." He added, "The advantage would be that we know we can generate vaccines against this virus, and relatively quickly. The disadvantage is that we would be back to the same situation we were about a year ago, depending on how much impact current immunity had against the new variant. Hopefully, evolution is slow, so that new variants arise that are only marginally evasive rather than one big jump. Dr. Mark Bagenlein from Imperial College University of London's COVID-19 response team and a member of the government's SPIM modelling group said preventing the importation of variants of concern with moderate to high immune escape properties would be critical, as these could lead to future wave orders of magnitude larger than the ones experienced so far. He said, "It is unlikely that such a new virus evades entirely all immunity from past infection or vaccines," adding, "some immunity should remain at least for the most severe outcome, such as death or hospitalization. We would most likely be able to update the current vaccines to include the emerging strain," he noted, "but doing so would take months and means that we might need to reimpose restrictions if there were a significant public health risk. The amount of restrictions would be a political decision and would need to be proportionate with how much this virus would evade current vaccines." It comes with a further loosening of restrictions in England in coming days, when fully vaccinated people and under 18s will no longer be legally required to self-isolate if they come into close contact with someone with COVID. They will be advised but not obliged to take a PCR test instead. Daily COVID cases have been hovering around the 30,000 mark. The latest figures from 13th of August showed that a further 32,700 had tested positive and another 100 deaths were reported. Meanwhile, all 16 and 17-year-olds in England will be offered a first dose of vaccine over the next week to give them some protection before returning to school in September. Britain's Health Secretary Sajid Javid urged older teenagers not to delay. He said, "Get your jabs as soon as you can so we can continue to safely live with this virus and enjoy our freedoms by giving yourself, your family and your community the protection they need." Boris Johnson's former senior advisor Dominic Cummings has already called on the government to publish a variant escape vaccine contingency plan and suggested MPs should explore ways of forcing ministers to do so. One scientist, speaking on condition of anonymity, said they would like to see the publication of the National Risk Assessment relating to COVID-19 contingency plans. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Menina Wilson is backing the move. She said, "It is critical that people have confidence in Boris Johnson's COVID strategy and trust him not to repeat the same mistakes of the last 18 months. She added, "Through refusing to self-isolate, breaking their own rules and making mistakes that have cost lives, the government has lost public trust. Transparency is the only way to begin winning that trust back." Stephen Reicher, professor of psychology at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, said, "It very much makes sense to be prepared. Scotland is setting up its standing committee on pandemics. It will be interesting to see what emerges on a UK level." Stephen Reicher said, "In the longer term, we need a systematic inquiry into what went wrong and right so we are prepared and also so that we can institute systemic changes to protect us. The pandemic has been like a barium meal which has exposed so many deficiencies in our society. We can no longer pretend we're not aware of them. This has been a deafening wake-up call. Let's make sure we don't press the snooze button." Government sources said Public Health England and others were monitoring the situation through rapid surveillance and genomic sequencing of the virus. The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "The vaccination program had built a wall of defense." They said, "We are committed to protecting the progress of the vaccine rollout and our world-leading genomics capability are at the forefront of global efforts to stay ahead of variants, with over 500,000 samples of genome sequenced so far. Official figures show the United Kingdom recorded 93 new COVID-related deaths and 29,520 new cases on Saturday, 14th of August. Data from Public Health England shows two doses of COVID-19 vaccines are more than 90% effective against hospitalization from the Delta variant of the coronavirus, the dominant strain in the United Kingdom.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 19th, 2018. It is for the people to be set free from corruption, subordination, lowliness, and ignorance. It was for this reason that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam left Medina in a message to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, and in reality a message to the history. He wrote, I am not rising out of selfishness or lust for power, nor to cause mayhem or pain. I rise looking for the correction in my grandfather's ummah. I see that things have changed in the society that the Prophet left. It is going towards the wrong direction, towards corruption. It is against the direction coveted by Islam and the Prophet had preached. I rise to fight against these vices.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein,
ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Imam Hussein's fight had two dimensions and can have two different fallouts. Nonetheless, both outcomes are good. One result was that Imam Hussein could defeat Yazid's government and take power away from those who oppressed the people and devastated the fate of the people, so he could arrange things in an appropriate way. If this had happened, the route of history would have revolved. Another dimension was that if Imam Hussein could not, for whatever reason, achieve political and military victory, then he would not by words, rather by blood, by resisting oppression, by a language that history will never forget, make his narrative flow like a perpetual and non-interruptible stream in history. This is what Imam Hussein did. Of course, those who claimed to be believers, if they had acted differently than what they did to Imam Hussein, the first case would have happened and Imam Hussein could have reformed the world and the hereafter at that time. But the people did not cooperate. The discussion about why and how the people did not act appropriately is a very long and exhausting discussion, which I elaborated to some extent some years ago under the title The Common People and the Elite. It included who failed to act properly, who was responsible for this behavior, how they behaved, and in which areas. I'm not going to mention this discussion now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.